This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Today on the pod, we look at BC's critical shortage of strata managers, just as promises to build more housing grows, and daycare woes. Childcare costs are heading down, but demand continues to grow. And is the Nordstrom liquidation sale worth it? We send our producers to investigate. That's all next on the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Just a couple of hours ago, the Vancouver Park Board announced there would be no Stanley Park Easter train in 2023. On their website, the Park Board said that the train event has been put on pause this year due to required repairs following a recent assessment. This, of course, comes after previous cancellations. In September, the Park Board announced that the Halloween-themed ghost train was canceled due to mechanical issues. It also canceled the Christmas train due to the same issue. Joining me now to discuss the issue is Global BC reporter and NewsHour and 11 o'clock anchor Jordan Armstrong. Jordan, thank you for joining us.
Always good to be with you, Jazz.
All right. First and foremost, now after the first two cancellations, is this cancellation a bit of a surprise for you?
No, it's not. And I will tell you why. I went to the Park Board about a week ago, sent them an email asking what was the update on the Stanley Park Easter train, because we're certainly getting close. And at that time, they told me, well, we're going to announce something next week. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. And I know you've been a journalist for a long time, Chaz. You know, when it's good news, they'll tell you right away. So when it's bad news, they tend to keep you waiting. And so here we go. What, 4 or 5 days later, we get the bad news. It's not going to happen. It's complicated to get it back on track. I think we can give the Park Board that. I mean, they've had to get an engineering firm in to do a full scale assessment, and then you know how big bureaucratic institutions work, right? You got to get everything on paper. You got to come up with a plan for the plan, and submit to perhaps more an updated budget request. So it's going to take some time. I think though what I keep coming back to, and I know hearing from a lot of our listeners and viewers, is how did we get in this position in the first place? How did this beloved asset that's been around for decades, more than 50 years, get into such a state of disrepair that it's going to take so long to get it back on track? That we still don't know, Jazz.
Well, you've been covering this issue for a while, and so the issue has always been, it's got a distinctive engine. This train is 60 years old. It requires hard to access parts that are very unique. You also covered that, and other trains or similar trains don't have that challenge.
Yeah, there's no denying that this train is old. It's a unique scale, so it's slightly narrower track than the majority of trains of the same make and model operating in North America. But having said that, many others are of similar vintage, not quite as old, but certainly, 30 plus years old. And as you say, they're very common. Like there are hundreds of these trains operating at amusement parks, zoos, family farms all over North America. They're kind of the Honda Civic of miniature trains. We went over to the island back in January, and at Gailey Farms, they have the same type of train, and they managed to keep it running with just a handful of crew. They put a lot of time into it. They put the money into it, but, fewer than five people managed to keep that train running, where you've got a big government organization here. Well, maybe not big government, but you know what I mean? It's a government organization here that is having trouble with it. And looking back at some of the information that's come out so far, I have filed into a Freedom of Information request to try and get some better answers on how we got into this position in the first place. I filed mine back in January. It hasn't come back yet. I did get a note from the city that they have now until May 2nd to get back to me. So I'm still waiting for my FOI. But Bob Mackin, a journalist published in the Business of Vancouver, a publication a couple of weeks back, he managed to get his hands on some TSBC documents basically indicating why the train failed. And this is from September. And according to what he got his hands on, there was rust and corrosion on the track's lower surface, rot and decay from heavy moss growth on the trestle, which crosses the pond there, branches obscuring the conductor's line of sight. The inspector found multiple rotten ties and loose spikes. Spike heads were not contacting the track, allowing movement as the train passed over. Multiple brakes were not functioning, and horizontal and vertical axle play was noticed. It goes on to say there was excessive wear in the undercarriage of passenger cars. So when you look at that information, you know, I think we can safely say that's not, most of that is not an issue of specialized parts or specialized knowledge. That's just basic upkeep. And that seems to be why this train failed its technical safety BC inspection in the first place.
Can you not just surmise from what you've described here that there, maybe it's just me, but there is a desire, no matter, certainly unstated, it's not stated, it's not written, that they would prefer that it not be around, that we just let it just erode away and to the point where we say, look, we can't fix this anymore, and the train just goes away, that there was at its point somewhere an assumption that that's what they wanted to do, and the best way to do that is not to stay up with maintenance, not to deal with all the upkeep that is required. It certainly seems that way.
Well, it does, doesn't it? I mean, you're looking at... how did it get like this? Like it didn't just become old last year. It's been old for a long time. So how did it get in this state? I mean, at this point, based on all the information we have, it would seem that it was not a priority for the Vancouver Park Board. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say that, this was September when the train failed its inspection. Of course, in October, we had the civic election. A wholesale or whole slate of new commissioners came into the park board, and they have said that this is a priority. The ABC commissioners have. They'd like to get it back on track. And indeed, in the bulletin from the park board today announcing that the Easter train isn't going to run, it does say in the second paragraph that a recommissioning plan to put the train back on track for late spring or early summer has been proposed, and a comprehensive timeline for repairs and regular train operations will be shared with the public as soon as possible. So they're saying that we do have a desire here to get it running again as soon as possible.
I find it interesting that you would think the park board would want to make more dollars. They certainly indicated that they want to raise more revenue because they have to go to the city for some of their dollars as well. But you got to generate revenue on your own property, and this train would be part of that. And so that's part I don't understand is it attracts people. You can probably make some dollars off it. At the very least, it should be able to break even in regards to the upkeep and all of that just based on its popularity. And the fact that it's gotten to this point where you can't have an Easter train, no Christmas train, no Halloween train, does speak to an underlying desire, perhaps in the past, of not wanting this train around, which I just, it is mind-boggling, that is for sure. Jordan, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jazz. Always a pleasure.
Well, an international student was swarmed and beaten by a group of people who ripped off his turban and dragged him across the sidewalk on Kelowna Friday night. Gagandeep Singh was heading home after buying some groceries at about 10:30 p.m. when he ran into a group of 12 to 15 people. It was St. Patrick's Day. And Mr. Singh, once he got off the bus, said he was beaten in the face, in his ribs, arms and legs. And then the group proceeded to grab his turban and pull his hair and drag him around. After Mr. Singh regained consciousness, he called a friend who called 911. Mahini Singh is a Kelowna city councillor. She has met with Mr. Singh, and she joins us now. Mahini, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. This is very important.
Yes,
it's a topic
it
that needs to be discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you give me a sense of what Mr. Singh's condition is today? Have you been in contact with him or his friends?
Yes, I talked to his roommate about 7 o'clock this morning. He went to the hospital yesterday. He was in emergency. He was fully checked out. And he has a concussion. He has he has injuries in his rib cage area. And it's very sensitive there, and his left leg is is in bad shape. And, he's just basically in shock as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, we know the basics of what transpired that night. How is the community reacting to what happened?
Well, the entire community, I'm talking about the larger community, everyone is in shock that this would happen in Kelowna, because this is not Kelowna. This is not, Kelowna is a very welcoming city. It's a very inclusive city. This is not what we want to see here. So everybody is very, very upset about the situation.
When you first met Mr. Singh, I understand you went and I think saw him on Saturday, the day and the evening after. What was his condition like? What did you see?
Well, as soon as I found out where he lived, and I asked if I could go see him, and I went to see him. He was lying in bed. His eyes were closed. Being a Sikh man, he had his hair, long hair, down. And he was speaking in very soft tones because he's injured in the inside of his mouth and he couldn't speak properly. So, and basically he was devastated. I put my hand on his arm and he said, "Don't, it's hurting me." And everybody sat around him in silence because everyone was shocked. He was in a lot of pain. He closed his eyes, didn't open his eyes, didn't want to engage in any conversation, just wanted to be.
Hmm. I know the police are investigating, early stages of that investigation, but is this being viewed by many as a hate crime?
Well, I'll tell you what, no one's taking it lightly. I understand the police have put their top investigators on this job. This is a top priority for them. I talked to two lawyers. Both said this falls within the definition of what could be construed as a hate crime. And I'm sure they're looking at it through that lens. Was Gagandeep there, wrong time, wrong place? Maybe. But the fact that they went after his turban, pulled his turban off, pulled the inside called the dastar off, pulled his hair and threw him on the ground, that to me suggests they went for what is a symbol of his faith. Now, that in my books, in my eyes, would be an act of racism. And I just talked to a lawyer in the courthouse and he said, that does fall in the category of a hate crime. So if that's what it is, that's the way it should be looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And I know investigating hate crimes is a long, long process, but this is something that we have to make an example of to say it is not tolerated. Even if this was something that happened at the spur of the moment, this is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Finish.
What is the reaction from other international students? Kelowna, like many communities, whether it's Metro Vancouver or smaller communities around North America, British Columbia, we have international students going to school here, working in many jobs in and around our communities. What is their reaction to? What are you hearing in Kelowna?
Well, yesterday I met with almost 50 young people, and they were really, really upset. And I asked them all to please think and be calm about the situation, not to react. They were afraid for themselves because many of them work, say, for DoorDash and other retail jobs and work late into the night. And often many rely on public transit. And they're concerned for their own safety. And many of our students are girls. So whether it's a boy or a girl, it doesn't matter. They're concerned about their safety. What about them? A lot of parents sent their children to Canada believing it's a safe place, which it is. And Kelowna is a very safe place. And this certainly sent shockwaves through the community.
Was there just, I mean, when you say there's anger and obviously people very upset, was there a desire to do something on their own just to find these people? I mean, you don't want vigilante justice,
yeah.
Of course. I mean, the reaction sometimes does lead to that, doesn't it?
And, you know, young people get their their blood boiling and they can rev each other up. So yesterday I told all the kids, you cannot, an eye for an eye will turn the world blind. So absolutely not. This is what I said to them. You cannot take the law into your own hands. You've got to let the RCMP do their job. They're doing a fine job. They will find, they will do a thorough investigation. And one of them in the crowd turned around and said, okay, today we listen to you. Tomorrow, don't blame us. I said, you cannot do anything. I gave them a very motherly lecture and calmed them down. And I think when they felt their voices were heard by the media and, you know, people in the general public have been reaching out to them, there was a sense of support that they saw. There was a sense of support. They weren't just on their own. The community is rallying behind them. So that brought a sense of ease and calm to the group of international students who were there. But certainly, you know what, it makes everybody a bit jittery and nervous, especially the young students.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mohini, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it. Look forward to chatting with you soon.
Take care. Thanks for your time.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Last year, Metro Vancouver announced plans to create a new $40 million campground and park on Bowen Island. Good news, right? I mean, who doesn't like a park? Well, not so fast. 500 Bowen Island residents recently signed a petition concerned about the proposal, specifically around overcrowding and traffic and many other questions that they have. Joining me now to discuss the proposed park is Andrew Leonard, the mayor of Bowen Island. Mr. Leonard, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you for having me on.
Lots to talk about. Love your community. I haven't been there a little while now, but it's a great little island, great place to visit. What are some of the concerns? I mean, I'm talking broadly about overcrowding and traffic, but what are some of the bigger concerns that residents have in regards to this campground and park?
So this is a large park on the far side of our island, and as you know, probably from your own visitation on Bowen, we've got a rich history of ecological conservation and recreational green space use on the island. And so for our community with a project this size, adding a park of this scale, it's like telling Whistler that they're getting another ski hill. So while the region would be excited, Whistler's immediate questions would be about things like traffic on the sea to sky, impacts on waste and water, impacts on their village and environment. And ultimately visitor use management as we see the regional use pressures expanding and increasing in the region. So those are the same concerns as what's being voiced here on Bowen Island with this park project.
Mm-hmm. And in that $40 million proposal, was there any suggestion to infrastructure improvement to deal with some of those concerns you've articulated?
I think there is. So you know, and my own concerns are that of my community, the impact of transportation and infrastructure and increased tourism. And I think most of those impacts have answers to them. But mm-hmm. we're awaiting a lot of information from Metro Vancouver on what commitments and solutions will be. So, you know, while Bowen Island has been grappling with the notion of this large park development for the better part of a year, the formal community engagement from Metro Vancouver only started this month mm-hmm. In their listen and learn phase. It has yet to conclude. and they'll be feeding that forward into a phase two and phase three of engagement that gets to some of the design elements and some of the commitments of the park. So, you know, I know that our community has been long waiting for this engagement. It was really robust here on Bowen Island. It was passionate and constructive. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that the feedback has both been, passionate and constructive.
Now, my understanding is this is preliminary and it may change a little bit, but there's going to be, within this park proposal, there is a day-use picnic areas and trails, access to the beach. There's going to be overnight camping areas with 50 walk-in, bike-in tent sites, 35 accessible drive-in tent sites, and 10 tent cabins. Are there concerns beyond just the infrastructure, the core philosophy of having more people staying and visiting Bowen Island? Because, you know, you do go there, residents, I'm assuming, go there for to get away from the city. Or part of this, opposition may not be the right word, but concern, is that just because they just don't want too many people coming to the island? And I don't mean that as they don't like visitors. I'm just saying that they're concerned that the way of life on Bowen Island may change just because you're going to have a lot more people coming.
And that's a good question. And I think we see that phenomena of the pressures that visitation and use brings to a lot of the outlying areas in the region. So there is certainly concern from Bowen Island. And, you know, we've heard it particularly around transportation and our ferry link and the ability for residents to be able to access amenities on the mainland, whether it's grocery stores, community centers, pools or medical appointments. So there is concern about what increased visitation means on the island. Mm-hmm. And, you know, given that we've been grappling with the idea of this park for so long, we're really looking forward to and want to be able to sink our teeth into what are some of the commitments and some of the actual visitor use management plans and park management plans that will mitigate or control or help Bowen in terms of infrastructure to manage those if a rezoning is to go forward.
What's it like for the camping? Pre-COVID, what was it like just in regards to a busy day, a summer day on Bowen Island in regards to ferry waits and traffic?
Pre-COVID, so I think, you know, pre-COVID and post-COVID are somewhat similar. So a busy day in the summer is, you know, the ferries are usually full during peak times. So, you know, during the rush hour times, because we do have a significant portion of commuters on the island and people come to the island in the morning and leave the island in the morning and do the reverse in the afternoons. And we see lots of pedestrian traffic. The cove can become congested. We have, you know, it's kind of jointly managed by BC Ferries and Metro Vancouver Lands down there. So there is a need for, you know, a dispersal strategy as visitors come to the island and seek to use some of the amenities that we have here.
Mm-hmm. What do you say? Look, there's going to be a small group of folks listening to this and going, wait, this is just NIMBYism. Folks on that island just want the island to themselves. They're not really open to allowing or wanting more people. What would you say to that argument that this is just simple NIMBYism?
I mean, I would go back to my original comments and that there might be a mismatch of views between on-island residents and those in the region. And what I mean by that is, as a regional amenity, the park has tremendous opportunities, and it's seen as a regional amenity. But for Bowen Island, it's seen as a large development project that has impacts. We've got lots of green space here already. We see lots of tourism here already, and that kind of makes our residents have the expertise and wisdom of lived experience to know the types of questions that need to be asked and types of circumstances that need to be mm-hmm. dealt with. So my view of the Metro Vancouver engagement process was it was really positive. They were able to come on the island, they were able to answer questions, and they were able to take in the feedback and the concerns and, you know, the very informed concerns of our residents, and we look forward to seeing what they're going to do with that and what the detailed plan is to mitigate some of the impacts of what's effectively a large development proposal on the island.
Mayor Leonard, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
We're speaking to Scott Jensen, Vancouver Park Board Commissioner. We're talking about the Vancouver Park Board today announcing there'll be no Stanley Park Easter train for 2023. Of course, that follows the fact that we've had no Christmas train in 2022 or a Halloween ghost train either. Hopefully we've cleared up our audio issue with Mr. Jensen. Scott, I just want to reiterate a couple of things we were talking about prior to the break here. So I want to clarify here, in your mind, there is no doubt that there was not enough upkeep on this train, and that is what has got us here today with the Easter train being canceled and to a certain degree the Christmas train and the Halloween train being canceled in 2022?
Yes. And again, in early September, the Transport Safety BC, first of all, is my connection better now?
Much better.
Okay, great. Thank you. In 2022, September, that's when Technical Safety BC, deem that this equipment failed. And so, and that's where we are today. And so we've brought in we had to source out and bring in engineers to assess this. And again, that was done in January. And so really a thorough of the not just trains but tracks and so from there, you know, we're into February 27th, a deeper dive and looking at where we are and kind of moving ourselves forward. Thankfully, some of the things that getting hands on the ground in February 27th made things look a lot better, and certainly that does give us some optimism moving forward that we will get this train operational sooner rather than later. But, again, I talked to you, I think, in late last year talking about my intent on having this train, my personal intent on having this train operational for Christmas. And then and it is frustrating. And maybe that frustration is why my telephone line got all mixed up earlier, but so we are really again pushing staff and making sure that this train is front of mind for all staff so that this train can be operational as soon as possible.
So can we expect it to be running in the summer then?
Again, that's early summers, but once the weather clears up, I don't want to give excuses, but snow did prevent some work from being done, some assessments from being done. For us, we don't predict any snow moving forward. And I hope that with, clear skies, that we can get, the track and the train operational as soon as possible. So, again, we are looking at, recommissioning and putting a single train into service in late spring. And that's for us to, again, make sure that we're fast-tracking. First things first, it must be safe.
Yeah, I get that. If it's early spring, I know it's hard to predict, but I'm going to assume that this Halloween and this Christmas, that train should be up and running for the public as well. If you can get one up in early spring, in 2023, we should see a Halloween train and a Christmas train.
Yes, and we are looking for the resumption of regular train operations, and that does include the ghost train and bright nights. And certainly those are, so far off in the distance that, if it's not done by late spring, there's going to be problems, honestly. This train has to get operational.
Why do you think there was not the upkeep in your mind? Why do you think there was? Is it a desire to decolonize the park, that this does not fit the priorities of the last council? What was the reasoning in your mind why they did not provide the dollars and the desire? Why was there no desire for upkeep of this train?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the past council. I encourage them to come on to your show and speak their opinions themselves. I will say that we have a great staff at the park board, and they've indicated that COVID did prevent some of the maintenance, and so I'm not going to get into anything other than the fact that where we are right now is that the train is going to be operational in late spring,
And, you know, we will return to full schedules for the Ghost Train and Bright Night.
Scott, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
There was much talk about a child care deal between the federal government and the provinces. Advocates say Canada is slowly making progress towards a $10 a day child care system, but it's still a long, there's still lots to do and a long way to go. Now, the federal government did invest $7.5 billion since April of 2021, and that has helped cut child care costs in most regions by about 50%. The devil, however, is in the details in many cases. How does that impact your local daycare? Because that those dollars actually end up with the provincial government, and they introduce various programs, including the Child Care Fee Reduction Initiative program here in British Columbia. Well, recently, a child care place location called Almost Home had to send a letter to parents because those fees, which those parents are subsidized with, they could not subsidize those parents because of the way the program was set up. Joining me to talk a little bit about the child care fee reduction funding is Cindy Ross, the owner of Almost Home Child Care and Preschool. Cindy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you for inviting me to talk.
I know there's a lot you have on your mind on this issue. First and foremost, what indication, now just explain to our audience how the system worked prior to the end of this month, because we can get to that in a second, but how did the program generally work for you as a person running a child care program?
Yeah, so the program was subsidized in a much smaller amount in years previously. So we were talking about $100 per preschooler was subsidized, and about $350 for an infant toddler. But as of December 1st of this 2022 passed, they changed the system, as everyone knows, to be a larger amount of funding that each parent receives. And like we said, it's $900 now per infant toddler and $545 per preschooler. So the amount of funding that is coming through the ministry to the care providers now is quite substantial, especially when you have larger facilities or, per se, a family day home where there's a homeowner running their daycare out of their home, and that is their main source of income.
Now, in this case, you've had to send a letter to parents who use your facility, your program. How did that come about?
Correct. It started in January when I received the invitation to renew my contract. Tried to log on to their brand new website that they launched in January, which I thought was kind of strange considering we're in renewal time that we'd launch something like that of this magnitude. I was unable to log in and was locked out. That went on for 2 months. I recently, just last month, was able to, or a couple weeks ago, sorry, was able to log in and submit it. But the problem here was I was not allowed to approve or get any sort of submission saying whether my parents would be approved for this large funding amount for April 1st. Now, not getting that means I have to tell my families with 2 weeks' notice that they have to now come up with the $900 or the $545, because I can't afford to float that loan, which could be a month, it could be 2 months, and in years past, it sometimes runs into September for approval.
How many students do you have at your facility?
I have 175 families, so this amount can run up to $140,000 per month.
Wow. Wow. So is this a technical challenge or is this a structural challenge within the ministry and how they're doing things?
I think it's a structural challenge. I did talk with Grace Lohr today and had a good conversation expressing my frustrations with the program. And this has been going on for 5 years, so this is not new. Mm-hmm. It's just the amount of money that we're now dealing with is much more magnified. So we have expressed my concerns about, you know, myself having to float that amount of money, as well as the day home provider, that's her only source of income. And what is she going to do when that money doesn't show up on April 1st?
So you've now told the parents, look, I can't float this. You're going to have to pay the full fee without the subsidy there. What kind of reaction have you been getting?
Tears, frustration, madness. I don't like doing this. It's terrible. I tried to wait as long as I could, hoping, you know, the ministry, but when I can't even get into the website to apply, it's difficult, right? So I'm waiting for 2 hours on the phone every day, trying to get through to talk to somebody. I'm sending unanswered emails. I finally lodged a complaint with the Child Care Resource and Referral this week because it was the only one person that would listen to me.
So what happens next? Now you're asking parents to pay. I'm going to assume they're going to do their best. Is there any way, you said you spoke to Minister Grace Lohr today, in the last few hours, is there any reprieve? Can they help you get you into the system? I mean, it is a structural issue. I agree with what you're saying. But right now, getting you to the end of this month and getting the next month dealt with should be the priority first and foremost, so there isn't an impact on parents and is an impact on you and your business. Has there been any sort of talk right now making sure the next week this thing can be solved?
Well, since I've made the complaint and has talked to Grace Lohr, I received temporary funding for the month of April.
Okay.
But after that, there is nothing. But I'm in contact with a lot of care providers throughout BC, and there are a lot of us that are still not approved, even for the month of April. So I don't want to speak to myself. I'm also representing the care providers all over BC, and there's a lot of frustration. This contract really is between the parents and the ministry, and that's where I would like to see some change in the way it's put out. We did have a subsidy program last year before this came in, and it was really effective, and I'd like it to go back to that, where the agreement is between the parent using the system and the ministry.
It seems, based on what you're saying, it's a lot for these child care facilities, let's call them what they are, small businesses, to deal with the administrative needs that I think the ministry is demanding here.
Absolutely.
Well, Cindy, I really appreciate you sharing your story. And as you said, there are many others who are also impacted, many other small business owners across this province impacted. We're going to try to stay in touch with you and do hope to hopefully find a permanent solution, not only for you, but for many others. And I'm glad April has been taken care of at this point. But like I said, it's a call from the minister today that required for you to get to just April. What about May? What about June? What about the rest of the year and moving forward as well? I really appreciate you sharing your story today for our audience and for parents as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, more than 1.5 million people live in strata-controlled housing here in British Columbia. I mean, you only have to listen to the housing debates that go on here at CKNW that we're going to see, hopefully, an increase in more housing being built, and a lot of them are going to be strata-controlled housing. And if you listen to this show and many others, we often talk about the death of the single-family home, which means greater density potentially in many of our neighborhoods, with more condos and townhomes being built. Now, as I say this, strata complex development has swelled, but the pool of qualified strata managers has been decreasing to the point the industry says we're on the brink of a critical shortage of strata management. Joining me now to talk about this issue is Chris Churchill, who is the president at First Service Residential. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's talk a little bit about this shortage first and foremost. Is this something that is new, or is this something that has been building over the last few years?
Yeah, I think the first alarm bell was really sounded around 2015. In 2015, there was roughly 1,200 to 1,300 licensed strata agents in British Columbia. And since then, the numbers remained relatively flat. So it's not a new issue, but I think that over the past 8 years, what we've seen is a very large population of baby boomers and folks that are approaching the retirement age which is putting, I guess, a critical situation in much more of a critical situation with 40 to 50% of the current licensed strata managers within retirement age.
And in regards to the industry today, what kind of strain are we seeing on a individual basis on a strata property? What kind of things? Where do you see some of those strains?
Well, what we're starting to see is that smaller stratas are having difficulty getting representation as the shortage continues to build. Smaller stratas, unless they're willing to pay much more money than what they're paying, unfortunately, choose either not to get representation or simply can't afford to get representation. So with a finite amount of strata managers and kind of a ballooning amount of buildings starting to happen over the past 8 years, it's just simply left the smaller stratas without representation.
Considered a small strata?
Yeah, a small strata, I would say, is roughly anything between 50 and 70 units. So that would be a lot of townhome complexes or small walk-ups.
Hmm. And so companies like yours, like First Service Residential, very well known in the industry, you would work on some of the bigger stratas, the high-rises.
Yeah, we specialize in high-rise, but we do manage stratas of all sizes.
In regards to this challenge that is there before you, what is the bottleneck here? One would argue, well, more housing, meaning there's more opportunity for strata managers, more opportunity for the private sector to expand. Why are we seeing this bottleneck?
I think it's an awareness issue is the biggest thing. I think that recruitment efforts have been, dependent on the brokerage. And as large towers, like, for example, we have 89 large towers that are currently under construction in the Lower Mainland, what would be deemed as high rise. And as these buildings go up and as there's a push for higher density and higher towers to go up, the industry has just simply had a very difficult time catching up to manage the supply.
And so in this case, what needs to be done moving forward? Is it a question of the industry needing to expand and government involvement of some sort? What needs to happen?
Yeah, I think the industry is filled with very credible professionals that have been entrusted with very significant assets and equity. And we need to support the growth of the industry through assistance in recruitment, education, and possibly training grants. You can't just all of a sudden become a strata manager overnight. There's a course that needs to be done, which usually takes 6 months to a year. Most brokerages at that point will make sure that you get training within the brokerage for 6 months to a year, at which point you're then able to hold a portfolio. So even if drastic action was taken overnight, we're still 1 to 2 years away from solving the crisis that we're in, which is where the urgency is right now.
Hmm. And for a company like yours, a large company, as I said, well-known in the industry, how are you dealing with it?
We've invested a tremendous amount of money into training. We have a training program for new strata managers. So anyone that's newly licensed can come into our company. We'll provide training and development, mentorship program, be able to work on small portfolios with a mentor manager, and be able to try to, supply our own strata managers. It's costly, but it's worth the cost. We also do a lot of training with strata councils. We feel that when strata councils are trained and knowledgeable, it makes everyone's life and job easier. Mm-hmm. We do webinars, trade shows. We have a podcast where we talk about hot topics on Spotify and Apple. It's called Strategize.
So. Mm. Now, there's been talk about obviously removing any rental restrictions when it comes to stratas. How much of an impact do you think that will have on the industry?
Well, I guess, I understand the reason. I guess it's a good idea. I think it was improperly executed. There's more move-ins, more move-outs with rentals and stratas. That puts more burden on strata councils, more burden on strata managers. We've all been renters at one point. You usually don't plan on living in that rental location forever. That means that we have new tenants all the time that have increased questions, increased inquiries, and so on. So just the workload in general in the strata complexes that are now going to be increasingly so rental communities, not just strata communities, it's tougher to build a feeling of community at times in those environments.
Now, you talked about just difficulty getting insurance. Are you hearing of cases where smaller stratas have been unable to get insurance, or it's much more difficult to find representation?
It could be a challenge in a strata complex that is heavily rental, as investors tend to be more inclined to defer maintenance and push, important maintenance schedules forward, which then results in end up being higher cost in insurance. Yes.
Hmm. If this continues in its present state, the way it is, where's the industry in two more years?
I think the biggest thing is that we're heading to a place, if not almost already there, where stratas under 80 units are going to have a very difficult time finding representation. And then on the other side of the relationship there is large towers are going to have a shortage of managers that have the understanding and expertise to manage these very large, complex assets. Both are very dangerous. They both come with a lot of litigious liability. They both come with, a long list of challenges.
Chris, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Nordstrom will close 13 Canadian rack and retail stores, including the Vancouver flagship, by late June.
Big sales are coming for Nordstrom Canada as it gets the ball rolling on closing its Canadian operations.
You're listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show on 980 CKNW.
Well, as you heard there, liquidation sales at Nordstrom locations across Canada will be beginning soon. During a court hearing today in Ontario, Chief Justice Jeffrey Morowitz gave Nordstrom permission to start liquidating its merchandise just weeks after it announced, of course, that it will be leaving the Canadian marketplace. Court approval was needed for Nordstrom to begin winding down its Canadian operations under bankruptcy laws here in Canada. Gordon Brothers Canada will preside over the liquidation process, which is not only the sale of the merchandise, but furniture, fixtures, and equipment. So everything must go. This particular company, Gordon Brothers, is also involved in liquidation of Target, Sears, and Forever 21 here in Canada. Nordstrom's, we are told, is what we're hoping to wrap up the liquidation process by June as it closes all 13 of its bricks and mortar locations in Canada. Now, Craig Patterson spoke to our colleague Jill Bennett earlier today. He's the founder and publisher of retail media site Retail Insider. We'd asked about why Nordstrom was leaving the Canada, as it is still a successful retailer, of course, in the United States. Here's what Mr. Patterson had to say to our Jill Bennett earlier today.
Again, I think Vancouver, Nordstrom did a pretty good job. I was in the store a few weeks ago and it was really quite terrific. But at the same time, I found that I wasn't really a Nordstrom shopper. I bought a few pairs of shoes, but I didn't find the clothing was the style that I wanted. And I was just in the Hudson's Bay store and I found all kinds of brands. And this is a downtown flagship, by the way, not one of the suburban ones, which aren't really usually in good shape. But, brands like Sandro and Ted Baker, these are brands that would attract me and I didn't really see them at Nordstrom. So I don't know if we shop a little bit more of it, in downtowns anyways, is it with a European aesthetic, but I didn't find that Nordstrom had what I wanted. And oddly enough, Hudson's Bay and Holt Renfrew do.
That was Craig Patterson, is it, founder and publisher of retail site Retail Insider, talking to our Jill Bennett earlier today. Well, we sent our retail experts to Nordstrom today. By that, I mean our producers, Stephen Chang and Ryan Lee Hall. They both join me now. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
Oh, my God, Ryan, did you hear that? We're retail experts.
We are.
Wow.
You could talk about all the experts. You don't know why sometimes certain businesses close. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. There is some interesting stuff at Nordstrom's, don't get me wrong. I don't disagree with Craig, though. Did it fit into the Vancouver mindset? I don't know. Vancouver retail experience? I don't know. But you guys both went downstairs today and looked around.
Did we ever?
Did you
ever? Did we ever?
So let me start with you, Ryan. What were your thoughts on what you saw?
Oh, Jazz, you know what? They didn't have everything on sale, but some of these prices, Jazz. I can't get over it. There was a nice shirt there, which, to be honest, for the right price, maybe I would purchase. Nice little collared shirt, yeah. Kind of like a golf shirt.
Yeah.
The regular price on it's about $875. And I saw that and I was like, yeah, you know, maybe if it goes down to like less than 100, maybe I'll think
about
it.
What was it on for right now?
Well, they did have that one on sale. It was on for like 132, I want to say.
So I guess there are savings from an
But
I don't know too many people are still buying $150 golf shirts, right?
No.
Most people aren't.
No, so, I don't have that kind of money, Jazz.
I don't know. I guess there's a certain clientele, but are there enough of those folks in this city to be shopping there on a regular basis to not just support a small little boutique, but it's a huge store, huge footprint downstairs. Stephen, how did you find it?
Well, first of all, I agree with Ryan in saying that these prices are insane. Like an $800 golf shirt, first of all, like we can't even afford that. Jazz, you get paid more than we do and still a big deal for you to even spend that much on a golf shirt.
I'm not spending $800 on a golf shirt. You know what it is? It doesn't matter how much money you make. This is me. I'm just not going to spend $800 for a golf shirt.
Exactly.
I mean, it's stupid.
Yeah,
right?
And that's the thing for Nordstrom too. I agree with Craig in the sense that like Hudson's Bay, you can find all these other brands for less, because the thing about Nordstrom is that their prices are really high. They're really expensive. So look at the sales that we have. The sales that we found are actually sales that have been occurring before the liquidation announcement. So they could drop even more. So I found a jacket that I actually wanted. It's $495 regular, but they dropped it down to $190. So I was kind of tempted. I don't have as good self-control as Ryan does. but I'm waiting to see how it's going to go starting tomorrow. I might run back before the show tomorrow, ditch our daily meeting just to go shopping.
You better go when it opens.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because now I understand you both were running some audio. You taped yourself as you were roaming through the store.
We did.
We went undercover. That's right.
Well, let's take a listen.
So we're currently looking at the pants of some unknown brand that's not specified in this section. But we're looking at jeans and pants are basically pants that are kind of going for half off at this point.
Yeah, we got sweatpants, we got dress pants, regular $80 on sale for $39.99.
Yeah, like this pair of dress pants here, for example, from Open Edit, it started at $89 and now it's at $57.85. So almost half price is basically what we're looking at.
I kind of want to shop right now.
We haven't got a payday. We can't shop yet.
I probably will come back here like every day.
Yeah. This is probably worth looking at because like not all the sections have been reduced yet. But there are some areas that we're starting to see that they kind of started taking down the prices. Okay, this jacket doesn't look bad here. Oh, it's not even. Oh, wait, it did.
Dude.
For $475 to $190.
Purple brand, just a regular zip up.
Dude, it's actually. Yo, I'm going to try this on. Hold my phone. I'm going to try this on.
Sure.
Oh my God, I'm so tempted now.
It's like a regular zip up.
This is actually not bad. Oh my God.
How much is it on sale for? It's regular $475.
It's from $475 to like, it dropped down to like, oh my God.
To like one something.
It's not bad.
Dude, it fits you.
Oh my God.
Trying it on, looking in the mirror. No, it actually suits you, man.
I know. Holy crap.
It's pretty sick. So.
I know.
Yo, if you want to cough, go ahead.
I don't know.
We're here.
It's $190 from $475. Actually, no, I'm going to ask the employee. So I'm just wondering what the directions here. Is this in the reduced section?
Yeah.
So did it go from $475 to $190? Is that
yes.
Okay. And was this reduced for like the liquidation or?
No, that was just a.
Just a regular one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Any reason with liquidation sales?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
We're hearing. Yeah. But
okay.
You'll know as soon as I know.
Ready?
We don't know anything ahead of time.
Oh, okay. It's all good. I just wanted to know.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we just found out that the liquidation sale starts tomorrow.
Yeah.
And employees don't even know when it's happening either.
Nordstrom's always got things on like super lockdown.
I know. Because this isn't.
So this isn't even. But that's still a crazy reduction.
I know. That's, oh my God, look at this.
$195.
So this is reduced from. $300 to $195,
and it's just a crew neck.
And it's not even
orange.
It's not even liquidation.
Yeah, it's not even liquidation. So there's sales to be had, but it sounds like it's going to get better.
Yeah. So these were reduced before any mention of any closing reductions. So these could even drop even more. So like for this jacket, I don't even know if I want to get it today. I don't know if I should get it today.
Hide it somewhere and then come.
Hide it somewhere and then come. Okay. Oh my God.
Look at this. Golf shirt, this long sleeve, it was a regular $830, and it's $132 right now. Brand's Theory. Honestly, I'd probably buy this.
Yeah,
but not for $132.
So maybe the best thing to do right now is to actually wait until the starts tomorrow.
I'd probably just wait.
Yeah,
because again, not everything's on sale. Only a certain selection.
Because I already found two things that I want here, and we just got here.
I think we
got
to come back every day.
We're coming back tomorrow.
100%.
Okay.
I guess we know the editorial meeting tomorrow will be delayed with you two guys lining up for the liquidation.
Oh, you're coming with us. Oh, we're going to do it from Nordstrom.
Well, exactly. That was just downstairs.
That was good. At least we got some. some information, some intel from the employee down there. So tomorrow is when they expect the liquidation sale to actually begin, mm-hmm. right?
That's right, yeah.
And I think that some of the news stories today coming out, they're also saying that. So I'm sure people will be lining up. So thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate the tour downstairs. And let's see if you guys do some shopping. Now, I just want to confirm one more time, Stephen. You would never pay $800 for a golf shirt, right?
No, Jazz.
Yeah.
I'm cheap.
I know you would. Would you pay $800 for a Drake concert? Yes. Admit it. You would.
I quit.
I quit. Stephen Ryan, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the Jazz Joe Hall Show live Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. on 980 CKNW and connect with me on Twitter at Jazz Joe Hall BC. Talk to you next time.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
3 nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.